So welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming. Before we get started, I just wanted to offer our thanks to our hosts and our co-sponsors. First, the indispensable to Ann Arbor Life Literati Bookstore, who welcomes us to their space once a semester. To WCBN Radio, who broadcasts and records our conversations. And special thanks to Brian the Duke Tomsick, who graciously abides our preempting his show once a semester. For what it's worth, he's also an excellent bowler. So let me tell you a little bit about our guest, Ellen Muehlberger. I just did it. We were just talking about how people do it. I just did it. Muehlberger. Ellen Muehlberger. And I speak German, so this is pitiful. Ellen is Associate Professor of Christianity in Late Antiquity in the Departments of Middle East Studies and History at the University of Michigan. She teaches graduate and undergraduate courses on ancient history, contemporary religious traditions, scholarly methods, and Coptic and Syriac language. She has held fellowships from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the American Council of Learned Societies. She edited Practice, a 2017 collection of newly translated primary sources about early Christian education, asceticism, and reading for the series Cambridge Editions of Early Christian Writings. Her new book has just dropped. It's called Moment of Reckoning, Imagine Death and Its Consequences in Late Ancient Christianity. It's out by Oxford, and it is available at Literati for purchase, perhaps the first bookstore to have it for purchase. And we should note that they are also this evening offering it at a 50% discount. So please get excited and get Ellen's book. She'll be happy to sign for you. So for those of you that are new to our series, what we do is we chat a little bit first about Ellen's processes as a writer, her products, what she does, how she thinks about writing, how she teaches writing. Then we will go through a series of quickfire questions that we ask every writer who's our guest, and then we'll turn it over to y'all for questions. So as you're listening to Ellen tonight, if something pops across your mind that you'd like to ask her, make note of it, because you'll get a chance at the end. Okay. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for coming.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Thanks, everybody, for coming out, too. It's a beautiful night, and here we are inside.
Yeah. But with windows, so it's all good. So, Ellen, I like to start with thinking about what it means to be a writer. And so what does it mean to you? And this is probably the first time someone's asking you this question.
That is actually the first time somebody's ever asked me that question. At least at first for me, it means to be a reader of a lot of things. I did not think of myself as a writer for a very long time. And I was 23 or 24, and I had just started a graduate program, and I turned in my first long paper for a seminar, and that faculty member said to me, "You need a thesis statement," and I literally asked, "What is a thesis statement?" Because I just did not know. I had gone through all of high school and my undergraduate without anybody teaching me that kind of writing. Many in the audience will know that I very quickly after that partnered up with a person who's very invested in writing pedagogy, my partner Gina Redmayne, who many of you know. And through that, like through knowing her and knowing her colleagues in the English department in that graduate community, I figured out eventually what a thesis statement was. I realize now, looking back at that, that I had been writing for a long time. I had just not been writing things down. So as a kid in high school, I was a debater, so I was constantly composing things, just doing it under time and not in a written fashion, just for oral delivery, and then it would be gone an hour later. But once I figured out that writing a thesis statement in a paper that you hand to someone else was just a far more polished and revised version of those ad hoc arguments one after another, then I thought, all right, I can do this. I can do this. But the main way that I learned how to do it, short of that little moment, was just reading everybody else's versions of arguments and reading, you know, academic nonfiction, but regular nonfiction too, especially just to see how people worked their words. I know that sounds basic, but I didn't know that that was a thing I would be doing, so I didn't pay a lot of attention to it until I hit 23 or 24 and then thought, oh gosh, I need to learn how to do this.
Right, and I don't think that sounds basic at all. I think that's something that a lot of us could stand to remember consciously all the time, you know?
Yeah.
Do you find yourself reading differently now that you know this about yourself?
I read very jealously. Not jealous of other people's success, but I especially if a writer has good turns of phrase or good syntax or kind of muscly prose, I will read that over and over to sort of get the pattern in my head.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess that's acquisitive, like a little, what's that bird that makes the nest by getting all the shiny things and
bowerbird.
Thank you, a bowerbird. I read like a bowerbird. No, really. I also obviously read for pleasure, right? Like I like the things that I read, but sometimes I will end up just cycling back through somebody's paragraph to see what they've done.
Yeah.
And to, I know this sounds weird, but feel what they've done,
right,
and feel how it develops over the, you know, 4 or 5 lines or 5 or 6 lines that they have.
Do you ever read out loud when you do that?
Sometimes, although it's more mental
recitation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Curious about that because I think reading out loud is so underrated.
It really
is.
Yeah.
So why don't we talk a little bit about what your new book is about?
Oh, this book is a study of a strange development in the 4th century. There are Christian writers who all of a sudden start describing to their audiences those audience members' deaths, and they have them try to imagine their future deaths, and they tell them it's going to be terrible and frightening and awful and painful. And this book is an attempt to explain both why that came about and what the effects of that were.
Wow. That's intense.
Yeah, I'm ready to be done thinking about death and nasty things. And,
right.
Yeah.
Now, your previous book was about angels.
Right.
So maybe
in the middle. No. Like, that was sort of light and fancy, and everybody, and, you know, people who were interested in supporting me could get me, like, little angel magnets or angel...
Right.
I did not get much of that this time
around. You should base your next book on what you would like to collect.
That's right.
So,
that's exactly right.
Yeah. Would you like to read us a little passage of your book
sure.
so we can sort of have it in the air?
One of the things that I found when I was doing this research is that the people that told those terrible, frightening stories, part of the reason they did that is because they had been trained to write in a certain way. Oh, it's simply the HVAC.
Oh.
I thought it was feedback. I thought I was doing something bad, but I just heard the deep
bass. I thought the aliens were coming.
Right. And these are all men, they're all men, who had gone through a kind of education that taught them to write in a certain format, especially when they were encountering tragic circumstances or somebody else going through tragic circumstances. The way that they learned to do that was they composed first-person narratives about what it would be like to be that person. So, you know, if I walk out of here and knock on wood and I fall down the stairs out of the cafe, you would all understand that experience, not by, like, looking at me, but rather composing, what would it be like to be Ellen falling down the stairs mm-hmm. after the Literati performance, right? So this piece is about how those kind of early writing experiences, the things that you do over and over again as a middle schooler or as an early teenager or even as an early writer, form you for what you do later, mm-hmm. and that they stick with you. So in one sense, I thought it was useful for today because we're talking about writing pedagogy, and it makes the case that the kind of exercises you ask people to do now are what is going to determine what they're going to do later. So it says, in any virtuosic program of training, the earliest exercises the performer undertakes are the most influential for her later practice. Take, for example, a ballerina. The way she's taught as a child to turn out the hips, the way she's directed in early lessons to point the feet or to strike the floor in preparation for a jump, all of these moves are the foundation for whatever she will eventually accomplish in dance. How she learns them is how she will enact them, even as they begin to be strung together into larger sequences of poses and movements. Their quality and consistency inevitably show through in the mature dancer, an insight that we can see also voiced about the rhetorical exercises, these ancient composition forms. For much like the early training of the young ballerina in simple exercises and positions can enable or disable exemplary performance in the future, the exercises one completes as a student of rhetoric help determine one's future capacities. They are, a 5th century handbook attributed to Aelius Theon explains, quote, the foundation of every pattern of discourse, the way they are introduced to the soul of the young person, that is by necessity how they will be and what comes later, end quote. If the preliminary work for a dancer or a writer is completed correctly, that work and its forms almost disappear as the performer commands higher order and more spectacular displays. But we should not mistake the situation. Early exercises are the necessary foundation. One ancient commentator on a handbook called them a miniature of rhetoric as a whole, each little piece of which bears the phantom image of the speaker's later complete work. And, what is more, the influences of rhetorical training extend beyond the formal presentations of an adult rhetorician. As the author of the handbook attributed to Thayon writes, we should know precisely how very important practice in the exercises is, not just for those who will be rhetors or speakers, but for anyone who wants to try their hand at poetry, narrative, or any other type of discourse. I think that puts a big burden on all of us who teach writing when it says things like preliminary work, if it's completed correctly, will show through. Like, we have an almost sacred duty, and I don't mean that lightly, to teach people how to use words in a way that they can expand on and not just be sort of straightened by or narrowed by.
Right. And I think that that has a lot to do with the ways that we think. You made a reference to falling down the stairs as the performance of falling down the stairs, right? Like, I think that that has a lot to do with thinking about how writing is not just this thing that happens on a page, but it's a sum of a bunch of different parts that come together. I feel like that's really beautifully stated in there. Yeah. So we joked a second ago about you determining your next project based on what you'd like to collect, but how did you land on this idea?
So I was working on this other book about angels, and there was some material that I just didn't know what to do with. People kept talking about watching someone die and then watching an angel come to get them and take them away. This is within Christian tradition, so these were people speculating about the end of life. And every single one of those descriptions has the angel or sometimes a demon dragging that person away. Now, this is a dead body. Very, very high-level intellectual Christian discourse would say there's a dead body and a soul that's immaterial that has left it, and that's what death is this split between those two things. And yet all of these narratives had the dead body and then something grabbable, and I'm going to grab the microphone, grabbable and draggable being dragged away from that. And I thought, wait, how does it compute that there would be this other thing, this other body, that can be punished, can be dragged away, can be rewarded? And then I started looking at Christian fantasies about how people get punished and rewarded, and all of those were really physical too. They were talking about people getting strung up by the eyebrows or up to their knees in the river of fire. And all of that requires us to imagine a physical body that's not the dead body and is not this like light immaterial soul that philosophers talk about. So I thought there has to be, there's some other cultural thread that is not being recorded that I want to go find.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So what did you ultimately find? Just,
I found a lot of people fantasizing about exactly that moment. And oftentimes, unfortunately, fantasizing about that moment for other people that they didn't like.
No one here has ever done that.
No. But, it started as a trope that was, meant for audiences to do for themselves. So if I were the preacher, I would say to all of you, when it comes your time to die, you will be afraid and regretful of all. And that very quickly changed into, let us now imagine what other people will be going through while they die, especially other people that are not like us or not in our community. And that is a dangerous turn, a really dangerous turn.
Wow. And so I heard you say that this comes, this idea came out of scraps of a previous project that you were working on. Is that generally how you come to new ideas, or do you have a brainstorming process, or how do you land on something that you want to do next?
So if I say baleen whale, do you know what I mean? That animal?
No.
A baleen whale is some fish or sharks will have teeth. Mm-hmm. And the baleen whale has a big screen of specialized, almost furry hairs. And he or she takes in water, and those furry hairs grab the plankton, and he digests these little tiny bits of plankton. And that's how this ginormous whale gets his food, out of little tiny organisms.
Okay.
So I, when I'm on the hunt for something new, or if I feel like I'm looking for something new, I take in a lot of material. Mm-hmm. And I just notice what stands out to me, or sometimes often what makes me angry. like because I'm angry that somebody has gotten it wrong or somebody's missing something, even if I can't yet articulate what it is that's wrong about it. Mm-hmm. So the things that stick to my, I guess, readers being mean, I don't know. there's just a lot of constantly kind of moving through new material, especially, you know, some secondary sources, but a lot of primary, you know, ancient sources, to just look and see what is it that is sticky here or what is it that needs explaining.
Yeah. Do you ever just go into an archive and start digging around?
Oh, so much of what I work on has already gotten either published or exists in some beautiful high-resolution image that a very generous library has shared with people. So I've only ever had to go physically to look at one manuscript that I couldn't see another way. But there are several resources. There's sort of catalogs of the material from my time period that I go through, and I just look at, you know, what's interesting, what hasn't been talked about. Because I don't think that really there's a whole lot from the ancient world that got preserved that isn't interesting in some fashion. Sometimes it's not interesting to contemporary scholarship because there's not an author attached to it, or because we don't know when to date it, or because we don't know who else to put it in conversation with yet. I will say yet. So I look for that kind of thing.
Let's linger on conversation for a second. I think that most of us in Sweetland are constantly telling our students, writing is joining a conversation, right?
Always.
Find the conversation and join it. So as you're looking for a new project, of course, you're looking for where the conversation, for what conversations it might join. Do you ever come at it the other direction where you see a conversation happening and you think, I need to get in on that?
Ooh, that's a great question, because I am in the middle of a career transition from being what is called an early career scholar to, I think I'm now sort of becoming senior. And that feels very strange, I know, but it is a thing that happens. And like every life stage, it will happen to you too. And, and I think that there's incumbent on that stage, and what comes with it is a need sometimes to look at a conversation and think, oh, I could say something in this conversation. And I don't have to say it in a way that, like, elbows my way in or proves something, but could be sort of a commentary, a helpful commentary that directs things. Though that is a very strange a voice for me to feel like I should take on, even though I see that it is now starting to happen.
When you are starting a project, or even in the midst of a project, is there a typical day of writing for you? Like, does it look the same on any given day?
It depends on what my other responsibilities are, but let's say, for example, that it's, you know, in the middle of June, and I have my time to myself. I usually get up pretty early, start a pot of tea, and I might, depending on how hot it is outside, I might either immediately go for a bike ride and then write in the afternoon, or I might write in the morning and then go for a bike ride in the afternoon. And I mention the bike ride because, like so many good writers that I know, have some other non-brain, non-composition, non-invention thing that they do opposite their invention and composition. And somebody made that recommendation to me early to mix those two things. And it's super productive for me because the back burner effect of I'm tootling along here on River Drive and all of a sudden I have figured out what I need to say or what the transition is that I was looking for. That happens all the time, such that I have to whip out my phone and like give myself a little voice message to say what it is that I, because I will lose it if I don't write it down at that point. So I would say I used to have an idea that you had to just sit there surrounded by snacks and stay forever and be up all night and, you know, caffeinate and all these sorts of things. And I found it's a lot more 2 or 3 hours of a day, and then everything else happens around it, and you have to be careful about what else you let happen. Because, you know, on days that I go longer than that, I will pay for it the next day in terms of attention that I can lay.
Do you start the next day by looking over what you've done before, or do you just keep plowing?
I often keep plowing because I'm a multiple draft kind of person. My first drafts are usually not inarticulate, but they just don't have, they're mostly like I'm summarizing and I'm saying, gosh, this is interesting. Oh, it's very interesting that this happened, you know, but there's not any content to those judgments and there's no analysis. So I usually try to get through one whole draft that I've outlined just to get it all there. And not in, I mean, people would use the phrase word vomit, not in a word vomit way, but just like, let me force myself to be as structured as I possibly can be at this moment, even though it's really messy and I wouldn't usually share that draft with anybody.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you outline.
I do. I really do.
What does it look like for you? Is it Roman numerals and all of that? Or
no,
is it...
it's, I had a very good writing teacher in graduate school, Constance Fury, who's at Indiana University, who said you should be able to read the topic sentence of an academic, every topic sentence of an academic argument and reconstruct the argument without reading the full paragraphs. And every little paragraph has its own topic sentence that is a thesis statement for the paragraph. And so my outlines are 50 topic sentences in a row that I think are going to work. And then the writing of them is the matter of seeing if that order of the argument and that kind of shape of the argument works or not. And it never does.
Right. Yeah.
The first time, the second time, the third time, it just doesn't. But those are necessary to get to the last one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so how do you move then from that first draft?
Painfully. Painfully, so painfully. You know, sometimes I'll share it with my spouse, who's in the house and is often, I will say, emotionally living through all the ups and downs of this with me. Sometimes I'll share it with somebody distant. Sometimes I don't share it at all and just start right back over.
Mm-hmm.
So those early drafts, they really, I think sometimes if you've seen Peanuts, the cartoon, not the newspaper cartoon, but the, you know, Charlie Brown Christmas or whatever, you know how the teacher talks, wah, 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 wah. Like, I feel like the first drafts are all that teacher voice because they're not articulate. You can tell that it's language, but you can't tell a thing that she's saying. It feels that way.
Yeah.
And then it takes a while for it to train itself up to get to be actual language.
How do you save a new draft each time so that you have all of the iterations along the way?
I do. And actually I write them out. So I handwrite.
Oh, nice.
I used to try to type and compose by typing and it just doesn't work with me. So if it works with you, awesome. I am so happy about your cyborg existence, but it just doesn't.
Yeah.
So I save up until I have what I think is a viable draft or several pages, and then that's kind of the scut work. So like when I'm brain dead, I can type for a while.
Oh, nice.
And then go back and draft some more or invent some more and then type. But I do save all the old drafts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I'm checking our time here. Oh, good. So speaking of saving drafts and of the revision process, how much of this do you bring to your students?
I try to say, I mean, I think of students as already having some kind of contact with writing, whether in high school or classes before they get to mine. So I just try to figure out what their process is when I meet them and to intervene in some fashion. I mean, all of us as writers need intervention, right? I am still working, you know, the next thing that I write will be, if not easier, perhaps more efficient than this one and the next one and the next one. So I try to figure out what they're already doing and coach a little bit. I mean, they don't need me to direct what they're doing. But in the same way that you can coach or sort of partner with a friend, I try to do that.
Yeah. What kinds of writing do you assign?
A range. So there's some at-home writing, you know, formal at-home, do your own drafts, turn it in without showing me the drafts, that kind of thing. But everything from there back across the spectrum to here's a piece of paper in front of you, you're never going to show it to me, but for 2 minutes you're going to make an argument and you have to choose, like you have to commit to it and do it for 2 minutes.
Oh, nice.
Because I think that the stakes of showing it to somebody else and also the stakes of being forced to commit to something work in two different ways, and the being forced to commit to something gets you out of the hedging process.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say this, I don't know that, I can't prove that. Like, and it just helps you discern what it is that you're thinking.
Yeah.
The stakes of showing it to somebody else is almost the opposite. I have to prove this. I have to show that. I have to, you know, get my footnotes. Like, all of that sort of stuff, the formalizing.
Right.
So I try to spread out a range of that over the course of a term.
Yeah.
And I try hard, although sometimes the size of classes doesn't allow it to happen, to track what a student's doing over the term.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I'm reading somebody's writing a week after a week after a week, and we're doing the same kind of assignment maybe 3 or 4 times, I might say, all right, X part of this assignment you have figured out how to do.
Mm-hmm.
Don't practice it again. Try something different, you know, and sort of rule out earlier forms of writing.
Yeah.
Or things that they already very clearly are good at.
Right, moving them forward in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you assign them things like what some might describe as a typical research paper? What kinds of projects do they do?
In the classes that might produce a research paper, I do eventually assign something long like that, but the previous assignments are aimed at making things hyper-transparent about how you might manage something like that. So we have one assignment where we read a chapter of scholarship or an article of scholarship, and then we break it down. You know, what is this person arguing? What is the basis of the evidence that they're using? What's their rhetoric like? What kind of voice are they taking on? Who are they assuming? Like, we just name all that stuff because, again, you know, students at Michigan are pretty well prepared, but my experience as an undergraduate at another institution was that I had no language for any of that. And I just thought, the professor signed an article, so I must learn this article, rather than I must engage with this as another product of writing that might be a model for me.
Right, yeah. And that whole process, too, of like, an article gets assigned to you, so you immediately assume that you are the audience for that article.
Right.
Which is very rarely the case.
So true.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
How do you discuss that? Do you...
Well, I mean, I often will talk about what an author is trying to do in terms of the author's credibility. So academic writing is, you know, there's some peacocking in it. And I mean that in a way that, like, we're trying to communicate across distances to people we don't know, and we're trying to both show our authority and use that authority to convince someone of something that we're arguing. So the showing of the authority, like, I like to point those moments out. There's an article that I published just before I got here. I was a brand new assistant professor, and I assigned it, I think, actually, a class maybe that one of the audience members, Matthew Woodson, was in. And we did a rhetorical outline on it. So we did, you know, here's the content of what this paragraph says, but also rhetorically, here's what this paragraph is doing. And I don't remember if it was the third or fourth paragraph of the article, but I very heavy-handedly cited such and such scholarship in French, big French title, and such and such scholarship in German, big German title. And I was like, rhetorically, what this is doing is it's saying, I can read French and German. That's all it's doing. I mean, it's making a content contribution to the article, but its real purpose is, I have the cred.
Right.
You know, I'm, you know,
I know what I'm doing.
Minted, but I know what I'm doing. Yeah. Right? And it's, there's so much of the I know what I'm doing going on that when you point it out to students, I think it makes the person on the page become an actual person and another writer in the room. Rather than some authority somewhere who I must now learn what they've said.
Right. And who everything they've said is automatically to be taken.
Indeed.
Yeah. So do you get to do any kinds of writing now besides academic writing? And if so, do you assign it?
No, actually. Oh. I mean, this is the thing. Well, I mean, it's not so bad. I love academic writing.
Oh,
yeah.
I have been, like, I am formed for academic writing. And I don't assign a lot of non-argumentative pieces. I do assign some kind of meta-reflection. Like, you've written this paper. You've gone through this big, long drafting process. Now tell me what was hard for you or what was easy for you and what's changed over that process. So that, but that's too part of the process.
Yeah.
So now, I mean, I'm surrounded actually in my social life by poets and
essays
and like all kinds of people, and I'm just not one of them.
Yeah. I think that that's exciting though, to know like, this is what I like to do and I'm going to do this. Also, now that you're becoming a senior scholar, should you get the wild hair?
I mean, there's that. I think also, you know, so I'll talk about the wild hair in a second, but as you were talking, I thought, oh gosh, I also do a ton of translating.
Oh, well, that's a whole...
Which is a different beast.
Right.
And it isn't writing, because obviously you're starting with a substrate, but it is writing in that the languages I translate from, one is Syriac. It's a relative of Hebrew and Arabic. So it has a fully different kind of sense of what good style counts as, and when you translate it kind of clunkily into English, it sounds super repetitive, very repetitive, because that language thinks the word for book and the word for writer and the word for writing and the word for written are all based on the same root, so if you can just repeat that root over and over. But we don't like a sentence that says, the writer wrote the written thing when she was writing in her writing room. Like, we don't want that sentence. So then you have to make the choice of, how can I convey that beauty? And it is really beautiful when a Syriac writer can do that. You're like, you're amazing.
Yeah.
How do you convey that in English in a way that's also to your colleagues who know Syriac going to say to them, yes, she did it correctly at the same time? That's hard.
And in the spirit of it, I would think.
Right.
You know, like oftentimes when we're teaching students to write and we're teaching them about summary and paraphrase and quoting, you know, do this with the spirit in which it was intended. And that's probably on a whole other level with
super
translation.
Hard. Yeah. Very hard. And thankfully, I'm on a team of four people on a big translation project, so we do a lot of cross-reading. Like, somebody will translate, then I'll read it, they'll do it again, somebody else will read it. So I'm never by myself doing that, but
yeah.
That is a different kind of writing, I'll
yeah.
say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's still creative. It's
yeah.
still,
yeah.
yeah. So what I'd like to do is move to our quickfire questions and then give our audience a chance
I'm
to
ready.
Ask some questions of
ready.
Their own. I did give these
ready.
To her ahead of time, but not super far ahead of time, so. And you'll notice, too, that some people don't want them and some people do. So, yeah, you're kind of the in-between.
I didn't even ask.
You're going to see how this
said,
goes.
Here are these questions.
Yeah.
I said, okay, I'm ready.
All right.
Rapid fire.
I'm ready to hear what you say.
Okay.
By the way, some of you will recognize the sort of structure of these questions. We did, in fact, shamelessly steal them from inside the actor's studio and make them writing questions. So, what's your favorite word?
I'm going to make a case for reclaiming a word that has taken some heat lately, and that word is moist.
Oh.
And I just want to tell you, watch your reactions, because there is a thing about hating moist in the last several years.
Oh, yes. My entire life I've hated the word moist.
Okay, but I was recently at dinner with a poet that I know, Ali Shapiro, who's over here, and she said two words to me about moist, and I thought, you know what, she's right. And those two words were, it's misogynistic. The way that we hate on that word. And I'm not calling you a misogynist, but I'm saying
no.
But, neither is Ali.
Internalized misogyny.
That, like, the, you know, soil that grows seeds is moist.
Right.
The air in June that's beautiful and doesn't make my hands crack is moist.
Delicious cake is moist.
Delicious cake is moist. And the way that we've taken that word and sort of made it into something gross or like, ooh, has to do with moist bodies. And it, especially in the ancient world, the moist bodies were the female bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just say that, like, there are these weird little cultural bandwagons that we all get on.
Yeah.
Moist was one of them. I was a moist eater, and now I am a moist lover. I am ready to be.
Nice.
I'm ready.
I appreciate that. See, she was so ready. She nailed it.
Well.
she's nailing it. What's your least favorite word?
Ooh. Interesting. And here's why. Because every time I draft something, the things that are interesting, like, this is interesting that so-and-so said whatever, or this is interesting that this piece of sculpture has this image when we expect that. And it is it's my little placeholder for where some thought has to go, and I have a gut feeling that thought has to go there, but I don't know what it is yet, so I love it. It does a job,
yeah.
But I also just hate seeing it in drafts because I'm like, oh, there's work to be done there.
Yeah. That's, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
What is your least favorite over or misused word?
Oh, forgive me, because in real life I am a descriptivist, so I don't really care about rules, but when people use comprise of, it just hurts me. It hurts me.
Yeah.
But it is a thing that is in the language now, and we all do it. I have even found myself doing it sometimes,
mm-hmm.
so, but it just, that's the one remaining prescriptivist thing in me.
That makes sense. What's your favorite overused word that you like to use anyway?
Oh. I mean, maybe interesting again. And look, I just overused it. Oh,
yeah.
My goodness. But it really, like, interesting, important, all of those words, they're, like, when they show up for me in my writing, they are doing me a favor to tell me that I have more to do.
They're signifiers.
Yeah.
For you.
Yeah.
Yeah. What thrills you as a writer and as a reader?
Ooh, what thrills me as a writer? These are so hard. What thrills me as a writer is, it's going to be hard to describe it, when I can say something that's grammatically correct in English but comes in a syntax that is weird or abnormal. And not clunky, but just off kilter a little bit. And this is, when I said I read jealously, this is oftentimes the kind of thing that I'll read over it. When a writer does that and just messes with the meter a little bit of what you're expecting, man. Makes me so happy. And
how
if I can pull it
do
off,
that?
Yeah, right. If I can pull that off, then I'm just all that much more happy.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's exciting. So what repels you as a writer and a reader?
Ooh. As a writer or a reader? That's hard. I'm going to answer as a reader. there is a certain voice that some writers will use that is, it pretends it's from nowhere, and it offers a picture of things kind of from a bird's eye view, and it makes kind of pointillist assemblages of things instead of making an argument. It will often use a lot of metaphorical language, and it is the grand sweeping history guy voice. and it repels me in part because I like seeing a writer's muscle, and I think that that kind of style is meant to be breezy and to look effortless, so you don't get to see the muscle. But then the other thing I don't like about it is that there are very few people who inhabit the social position that we afford that voice to. I'm not one of them. And so there's a little bit of resentment underneath all of that.
Sure.
But watching people take on that voice and maybe not necessarily recognizing that it's not available to everybody in the room, that bothers me.
Yeah, makes sense. So whose writing style, other than your own, would you like to attempt? Could be genre, too.
Well, all right, so this is a very strange coincidence, but there's a book sitting over here on the table to the audience's left by Allie Smith called Artful. I don't know why it's there, but that is actually a book that I am attempting to imitate in my next project.
Ooh.
Yeah, so if you haven't read this book, Allie Smith, who it was a gift also from the same poet I mentioned earlier, Allie Shapiro, Allie and Allie, that book is a fiction-nonfiction mix. The conceit is that this is a woman who's writing through four lectures that her deceased spouse was supposed to give, and now she's like sort of working through the papers. I'm not going to attempt the fictional part of that, but they're kind of thinking back to that voice that I was being resentful about a little bit earlier. There's a pattern in my field of when people, especially men, get to a certain age, they get invited for a series of lectures.
Right.
So you get to give three lectures, the such and such, you know, the Manus lectures, you know, the endowed Manus lectures at University of Texas or whatever. I, in this body, am not going to get invited to give those anytime soon. But that doesn't mean that I can't write four lectures as if I were going to give them.
Right.
So that is the structure of the next project, and I is to attempt to write four lectures as if they're all due next June and see what happens. Because this book and the book before it were super heavily researched, dependent on a ton of translation work. And I thought, why not try something a little bit more speculative, though not fictional? Like, I'm not headed down the Allie Smith fiction road.
Right, but not exactly academic either. I mean, it's academic-based, but it's not academic writing in
it's
the way
that we... It's still based in the ancient world, like observations about some things that I'm noticing about ancient literature, but not heavily researched in that same way.
Yeah, I can't wait to read that.
You and me both.
Whose writing style other than your own would you absolutely not like to attempt? Maybe grand sweeping history guy?
Well, I live with a horror person, so Jack Torrance. If you don't know who that is, it's the main character in The Shining, so he goes off by himself and has a very bad time trying to write a manuscript that he can't actually get done. You know, I mean, it's a joke, but at the same time, I think that kind of isolated... I have to be separate from the entire world. Leave me alone. I can't possibly teach, and I can't possibly go meet my colleague. No. Like, that is just not my style.
Yeah.
It's too hard, and it's too lonely.
Yeah. And I love that you took that about process. I think that's great. Like, that's such a... Because I think we get so focused on, when we're thinking about style, we get focused on thinking about prose, and then you just open that question wide up. That was really exciting. So, finally, what three or four writers, living or dead... would you invite to an ideal writing workshop?
Oh. All right, so I had kind of an ideal writing workshop about a year ago on this book, and I can already answer two of these because I invited two people who were amazing. A woman named Annette Yoshiko Reed, who works on ancient Judaism and sort of the cross between ancient Judaism and some ancient Christianity, who is just the most sharp reader, consistently asking, what is significant about this? I mean, in a sense, if you think about the way that interesting works in drafts, in third and fourth drafts, sometimes that word interesting disappears, but there's still a contentless placeholder. She had a nose for every contentless placeholder in the manuscript that she read. The other person I invited, his name is Andrew Jacobs. He just is so widely read and also so, he He's smart as a writer, productive as a writer, but he is very encouraging. So they were great. That takes care of half of it. But now I have to think of two other people. Okay, this is easy. N.K. Jemisin, if you have not yet read The Fifth Season, oh my goodness, you need to go read it. She's a science fiction and fantasy writer. The Fifth Season is the first book in a trilogy that is amazing in terms of its built-out world that you don't get to see all parts of, but you definitely experience the affect of that whole world. Mm. The reason I say her is because, so that book I think came out in 2015 or 2016. She has 5 books before that. She started publishing novels. She had done a bunch of short stories and other things, but publishing novels, I think her first novel was 2010. Mm. So in terms of productivity,
wow.
And here's where I should give a shout out to Ray McDaniel, who is the person who first recommended Fifth Season to me. I still need a 4th person, don't I?
You don't have to. 3 or 4.
Another person, though. Adam Serwer, who writes for The Atlantic, who's a journalist. And he's not a historian. I don't even think he's trained as a historian, but he has just a clear sense of everything that's coming down the pike. And once he names something, as soon as he names it, you're like, yes, of course, that was a thing in the world. Always. I remember that at all times. And you don't even remember the moment when you realize he's named the thing. And your life has changed because you see it differently.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would bring him in terms of clarity.
Right.
Yeah.
It's awesome. So at this point, I would love to turn it over to audience members who have questions. I apologize for the noise here for a second. Oh, we're not. There we go. Aha. So who has questions for Ellen?
Hey, Ellen.
Hi.
So a lot of people have talked about Twitter, and I know that you're on Twitter. And the effect that it has on their writing process, being able to engage with other scholars they might not otherwise be able to engage with, or thinking kind of metacritically about their own writing process. And so I'm wondering if you have found that Twitter has informed your writing process, or maybe it's just some kind of like fun thing you do on the side. But yeah, I guess I'm wondering about your intersections between the world of Twitter and the world of your research.
You know, I hear people make a comment about Twitter that it teaches you to think very shortly, or that it somehow disrupts long-form thinking, and I have not found that to be the case. Mostly for me, it's intellectually social. You know, like it's a chance to connect with people who are writing about the same things that aren't necessarily in Ann Arbor. And also just to, like, talk with people about writing processes and recognize, to cheer on people who have finished things and to recognize when things are hard. Because we're all going through the same cycle. I mean, I this may sound sort of universalistic, but I don't think it matters what genre you're working in, but the cycle from I have a great idea, oh, this is so hard, oh, I just have no idea what I'm doing, oh, I have a great idea, I have to revise this, oh my goodness, how will I ever, that is, I think, universal. That may be the one universal thing. So it's nice to actually be in contact with other people.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What's up, Ellen?
Hi, Henry.
Super interesting.
Hey.
I wanted to ask about interesting, the word.
Yeah.
No, just crickets.
That's right.
So I think there's a referent there that isn't just a placeholder.
Ooh, tell
but
me.
But I struggle. Well, I don't know what it is. It might not have. I mean, that might be the best word that we have for whatever that thing is. But I'm constantly asking for it from my students. No, you have to say something. I say original. I say weird. I say surprising. But whatever the words are, they never quite. It's hard to teach, right?
It really is.
Do you have thoughts on like how you get any level of student to either when they're reading say, huh, that's interesting, and kind of have a kind of and vibe with it and be able to say what it is and then write it? Do something that's writerly, form or content?
So I put interesting and important, its friend, in the same bucket as things like explain, unpack, deploy, like these words. Because interesting and important do the same job as those words, which is to say they describe what the writer thinks the writer's going to do rather than describe the result of what the writer has thought about or done. And so when I say something like, oh, this is interesting, all I'm saying is I will at a future moment describe my actual thoughts about this. Mm-hmm. In much the same way that like at the beginning of something I might say, I will compare these two things. That's not a statement of what I've found when I'm comparing something. So I try to make a distinction between, I call all of those words conjuring words. Like you're sitting there as a writer and you're trying to conjure the piece that you're writing, and you often do it by describing the actions you will take rather than the results you get from those actions. So I try to make a distinction between yes, you have to do this kind of intellectual exercise with your brain about those things, but then you have to convey the results of that. And saying something is interesting is not a result. It's just a marker that it's a thing that's remarkable, right? You've said, this is going to be interesting, I just don't know what I'm going to say about it yet.
Hi.
Hey, Deborah.
Wonderful. Very, very interesting. In your turn.
See, it's irresistible.
To listen to you. I wanted to ask you actually to think about the book in relationship to what you were saying, and the section on rhetoric that you read, and the larger discussion of rhetoric, and the way in which writing comes to shape worldview, which comes to imagine a world after death and a process there. So can you reflect a little bit on your own writing or writing that is around today and the way in which it too is grounded in a certain worldview that then comes to reflect upon where we actually stand, what relationship it has to a future or the lack of future, perhaps sacred or political resonances?
Yeah, I can answer in both super personal and more broad ways. So super personally, I mentioned earlier that as a high schooler, I was a debater. And if you were a debate person, I was a first negative, which meant my job was to listen to somebody's positive case and be the first speaker that tore it apart. and tore it apart in a 7-minute speech that had to be almost extemporaneous. If you look at almost all of my academic writing, it has that pattern. Here is something that is out there in the world, and here's why that person is wrong. And I have a much harder time as a writer. It's a lot more of a challenge for me to build up that second piece that is, here's the new positive thing, because the exercises I undertook as a young woman taught me a lot of tearing down. So I, partially with the next project, I'm trying to be a bit more what I think of as speculative, but really I could say constructive or affirmative. And that got reinforced for me a couple of falls ago when somebody recommended Rita Felsky's book to me. This is an academic, I do not remember the title of that book. If anybody does in the audience and can help me out. Does anybody remember? Sorry. It was a book that diagnosed and offered some suggestions about how academic discourse does precisely the thing that I just...
The Limits of Critique.
The Limits of Critique, thank you. It diagnoses how we do that, and then how we don't necessarily always turn to the affirmative or to the positive case. And I think that as we come into a new time where I think not just academics, but in general, the public intellectual work, and I don't mean people who are famous, but I mean all of us doing the work to change the intellectual sort of temperature of the culture, all need to move to that positive thing. I say that as a person for whom that will be quite a challenge, because my first negative skills are highly honed. They're at this point, 35 years old. So it's going to be a different kind of writing for me, and I think a lot of us will have to be turning to a slightly more constructive or affirmative way of thinking.
Do you have another question up here? Thinking about the first negative tendency to tear things down, and also just, which is my biggest fear, a conference of people together, like really inspecting my writing. I was wondering how criticism fits into your writing process and how you react to criticism, and maybe how that's changed since you were 23, 24, and
yeah,
just starting to write.
Yeah. I think the reception I have of feedback now is different than it used to be, in part because I'm in a community of people that we're all exchanging drafts at all times. So I feel like I have equal stakes with the other people in the room. It's not so much me up here and then a room full of first negatives ready to tear me down, but me up here right now, and then we turn the chair, and then it's you next week, and then it's you next week, and then it's Molly next week, and then it's Anna the next week. Like, once you have a group of friends, and it doesn't have to be big, but once you have a group of writers that you're doing that with, it feels a little more trustworthy. It also means that people can give you more direct advice. I think the kinds of things that I would say to a stranger that I didn't know who I had just read are far more guarded than somebody I would say, something that I would say to someone who had read my work, and I've read a lot of their work, and I'd be like, no, this isn't working, or, you know, you can do better, you know, like the kinds of things that we might even say to ourselves when we're being hypercritical.
Maybe we have time for one last question. Walking to the back of the room, and we're walking.
Thanks. Hello, great talk, thank you.
Hi.
Question I have is involving, you talk about transitions for different periods in your career, and because of personal experiences I've had, the difficulties I've had, the transitioning or I'd like for you to talk a little bit about the challenges you had when you were working on the first book after the book that was based on your dissertation. And if that process felt freeing for you to have not be locked into the work you did in graduate school, or whether it was frightening, if it was frightening, how you might have gone through that and how you navigated that.
Got it. So this is the first book after the book that was based on my dissertation. So this is the first book that I've done that did not involve a draft that I created in a graduate program under somebody's direction. For me, it was a kind of emotional terrain that felt very similar to the dissertation. And so when I would get to the point of being super excited and writing proposals and writing, you know, the kind of feelings that you have right at the start, I thought, oh, right, hi, friend, I remember you, enthusiasm. Like, you're my friend, and you're going to help me power through this. And then, you know, when you get to the point of actually having to structure a chapter and having promised X, but realizing that X is not going to happen, but maybe X minus 2 plus a couple of other things is going to happen. That feeling of disappointment and management of, I have this great ambition of what this could be if it came out perfectly from my head, and yet both the evidence and the limits of language will not let me do. Like, managing that distance also felt super familiar. And I mentioned biking before. I think probably other people have other practices. I do a lot of long distance bike rides. And all of that same emotional terrain is, you know, I'm up for a 125-mile ride today. This is going to be great. It's going to be so fantastic. And then 30 miles into it, you're like, oh, right. This hurts. I remember this all hurts. It's cold. I don't want to be out here. By the end of it, you're tired and you can barely remember. And then, you know, you come home, you have dinner, you have a beer, and you're like, look, I have a brand new ride right here. Look, it's finished. And then I expect that the whole thing will start over, you know, like, so I think the one helpful thing was knowing the emotional terrain and being able to just mark it and be like, right, I remember you. This is a natural part of the process. It's not a sign of failure. Even when it feels like total disaster, it's not a sign of failure.
I feel like that's such a wonderful place to end because it's so hopeful. Now we can all talk ourselves down from the ledge. Well, thank you so very much for coming. And it's been wonderful to talk with you. Everyone, please purchase Ellen's book. It's on sale. And it's the first. I mean, the first book in this store. It's been shipped elsewhere, but for all we know, no one else has opened it yet. We are the first.
That's right.
All right. Thanks.